It's Central Time. I'm Keeley Voltina in for Rob Ferret, and you're with us here on the Ideas Network. Today, we'll check in on the debate about whether gray wolves should still be deemed an endangered species and why that matters to you as a taxpayer. First, Wisconsin-based Quick Trip has a strong enough following that one couple has committed to being married in the store. The gas station is not alone. Other Wisconsin brands also have these cult-like followings. Harley-Davidson, Pabst Blue Ribbon, even the recently revived Midwest Express Airlines. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What brands do you love to love? Are they based in Wisconsin or is it from someplace else? Give us a call, 800-642-1234. You can also leave a comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tom O'Gwin is a professor of marketing and the Irwin Mayer Distinguished Chair in Business at UW-Madison. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
So cult brands, we're throwing around that term already. Yep. What are we talking about?
Well, generally cult brands are brands that have an extreme level of devotion directed to them. There's usually some kind of ritualistic, a lot of symbolic behavior around them. But just a deep level of devotion is usually the key.
It's not like I like to wear this particular brand of jeans, so I just keep buying this particular brand of jeans, right? Like there's this emotional connection.
Right. Somehow. And brand loyalty in general, the highest form of a really true brand loyalty is if there is an emotional component to it. So you can buy a lot of things from habit just because you always happen to buy this certain brand and have very little emotional connection to it. But when you have a lot of emotion connected to it, you may drift over into, you know, a communal brand, a tribal brand, a cult brand, which are all slightly different. But cult is probably the strongest term that is applied to a brand.
Okay. Well, we already have someone who would like to voice their support for something. Let's go to William in Racine. William, tell us about it.
Hi there. Well, Hi. I'm actually a member of the Wisconsin Quick Trip Enthusiast Club.
That's what we're talking about here.
Everything.
Okay. So why are you – you're like an official member. You're a member of the Facebook group or something?
Yep. Facebook group and everything.
Okay. And what prompted you to say, this? My allegiance is so high here that I need to do this and show my support?
Well, for starters, I really like Quick Trip's products. They're one of the few places I can get the unleaded 88 gas, which is makes my car run a lot better compared to standard unleaded. And along with that, just generally speaking, I know friends who work for Quick Trip versus other gas stations. They prefer to work there and to shop there. I just enjoy the standards that the stores themselves actually carry themselves. Good products. The fact they're open 24/7 really helps a lot of times.
Sure.
I'm on the road a lot, so.
All right. Well, William, thanks for sharing your story. Tom, what do you hear there?
Yeah. Well, I too. In fact, I'm sipping some Quick Trip Karuba coffee at this very moment. I make many trips a day to Quick Trip. If you say it's a cult, I'm going to believe you. It is certainly one of the best managed convenience stores I've ever seen in my life. In fact, I've never seen brand loyalty to a convenience store come anywhere near that.
Well, and, you know, our caller is not the only one. We have several comments about Quick Trip on our Facebook page at the Ideas Network. Neil said it's good food, okay prices, good quality. They treat their employees right. And James also said, I get my morning coffee there every day. It's so cheap. The staff is nice. Also treats its employees less horribly than other gas stations. But there is that aspect where there's, a moral connection to what
right.
they think the company is doing.
Right. And in sort of a larger category, in when you talk about a community or brand community, the three things you have to have are a sense of we-ness or a sense of we are a collective that are different than other people. So Quick Trip people have to be different than other people, and I think you are. And secondly, there's a little bit of ritualistic things, and the store encourages you to use your frequent Quick Trip card. Mm-hmm. And there's also a sense of moral obligation to other people. And that's really true at Quick Trip. It is employees love working there. People like being in the store. They're friendly without acting like that. They get points for being friendly. I think it's it has all the characteristics of a of a community at least, and it probably a cult.
So how much of this, though, is the company creating this sort of atmosphere, this experience, and how much of it is a fan themselves going, you know what, this is what I believe and I love this? I mean, can we figure that out?
Yeah, you could. I mean, I haven't in the case of Quick Trip, other than I think it's both. Brands that where this evolves organically, in the case of Pass for the Ribbon, which was almost out of business and then came back purely because of consumers, not the company. The company was smart enough to stay out of the way of an organic movement, which is hard for brand managers to do. But I think in the case of Quick Trip, it's both. I think it's a company with a lot of just good understanding of what makes their service special. And it is the consumer-to-consumer camaraderie of people. People stand in line there. And we stand in line all the time, right? But you talk to people in line at a Quick Trip differently than you talk to people in line at the grocery store. I think you're much more likely to talk to people. I think the way they have it laid out, it's a smart store design. But I think people feel very comfortable with other Quick Trip. They feel a familiarity to them that goes beyond any kind of rationality.
You really are describing a community.
Yeah.
Tom O'Gwin is a professor of marketing here at the UW-Madison, and we're talking about cult brands, and you're part of this conversation, 800-642-1234. Let's go ahead and take another caller. Ian is in Williams Bay. Ian, what cult brand is your favorite?
My favorite is Culver's.
All right, and why does Culver's have your dedication?
I think they're really like a unique fast food chain, especially for the Midwest. I think they really capture like the Midwest idea of what good food is. And they have things that just other places don't have, you know, like fish dinners and cheese curds, of course, you know, can't go out without those.
Right, right. All right. Thanks, Ian. I appreciate that. You know, Wisconsin, birthplace of Culver's, also home to the world's largest Culver's.
Yes.
It's a big deal here.
It is a huge deal here. And I moved here from Illinois and 15 years ago and didn't really – they had some Culver's. I didn't quite get it at first. And it took me, you know, 3 or 4 years to kind of drink the Kool-Aid. And but now I am that way about Culver's as well. I find it – that you put up with things like what, you know, you go wait at sort of inconveniently for your food to be delivered. And that is so outside the norm of fast food delivery and the way they do all their things that it makes you appreciate it more. In fact, you've endowed it with a little bit more of you because you've had to put in some work of finding the place to park and wait and put a little number on your thing. I think they do a very good job of ritualizing it and doing all the things that build cults.
Right. It's an experience.
It's very much. It's more experience than the food. The food is very good, very high quality, but it is people buy – we're an experiential economy, and people buy experiences probably more than they buy the product itself.
And Joel on Facebook also said Culver's said good food, friendly service, apparently happy employees. So again, yeah. We're pulling that line all the way around in the circle to say also this moral connection to it. All right. We're talking with Tom O'Gwin in studio with us today about Wisconsin's cult brands, those brands that we love to love for reasons, well, we can't always explain. Tom's a professor of marketing at UW-Madison, and you're part of this conversation. You can join us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Our conversation continues here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina. Right now, we're talking with a professor of marketing who researches brand communities. And there's room for you in this discussion with Tom O'Gwynn. And let's go to the phones right now. Justin in Minocqua has something to say about his cult brand following. Justin, tell us about it.
Hello. Love the show. And I think it goes without mentioning that New Glarus, and especially Spotted Cow, should be mentioning.
All right. And why do you want to mention Spotted Cow?
Well, one story in particular, I went down to Mexico for a concert last year. And on a Facebook group, I just happened to mention that I was going to grab New Glarus. And I had about 10 other people across the entire country ask me for it.
Wow. Interesting. Thanks, Justin. I appreciate it. And I have to admit, I went to South Dakota, where my family is from, over Thanksgiving, and I also had a request for Spotted Cow. That's a thing.
It is. I come from Texas originally, and my Houston in-laws always want Spotted Cow. It has developed a cult following. I went to a retirement party in Los Angeles last May, and when I asked if there was anything I could bring, they said Spotted Cow. They're very smart in their marketing. One thing, you know, they don't distribute outside of Wisconsin.
That's what I wonder about, though, because the other brands that we're talking about, Harley-Davidson, Quick Trip, Culver's, a lot of these are open to a lot of people. Spotted Cow has this very specific geographical range. Does that contribute to the cultism?
Oh, sure. It's brilliant to restrict. When you create scarcity, you tend to create demand. You know, when you create this artificial, I don't know if it's artificial. I know they I don't know what their production facility is capable of or why they restrict it to Wisconsin. But from a marketing standpoint, it's very smart because they make it available only in Wisconsin. So you create this national demand for it. It was like, you know, Coors did that originally with restricting Coors to only three or four states, and then people all over the United States wanted it. They got it, and then they thought, well, it's all right. I don't know. But when you make something scarce and restricted, people want it.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. Let's go ahead and also go to Tom in Madison, who wants to talk more about these Wisconsin brands. Tom, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Good afternoon. I have said on numerous occasions that every single town in Wisconsin needs to have both a Quick Trip and a Culver's. I think even despite small populations, they do very well. But more importantly, those two companies should incorporate under Wisconsin law and sell stock exclusively to Wisconsin residents, just like the Green Bay Packers.
Interesting, Tom. Tom's hitting on this idea that we've got that connection. We feel like we're owners in this, and we should kind of have an advantage. What do you think there?
Yeah, I mean, that's very interesting. Not an attorney, but right. So I don't know anything about it. But that idea is, it makes a lot of sense from a marketing and a sociology standpoint in that when you believe something is your brand, it has enormous power. It used to be, I don't know if it still is, but at the Brandenburg Gate, when you went from east to west Berlin, one of the signs you saw when you could cross the border was an East German brand of cola. I can't remember the name of it, but they said in German, "Our brand." And when you would at night in East Germany, they would want to drink this East German cola. And you'd ask them, "Well, do you like it because of the taste?" And they go, "No, it really tastes pretty bad, but it's but it's ours. It's not the West." And people get very provincial about that, and it does create a sense of unity and we-ness that is really good. And you tend to find that at its highest strength when brands have low shares, actually. So when a community or a cult or a tribe is its most threatened, you tend to find the most extreme behavior. So that's when Apple was a tiny brand, they were one of the first brands we studied, they were extreme in their behavior. They were cultish. When they grew to have a big market share, it was hard for them to hang on to that.
Yeah. Tom O'Gwin is a professor of marketing at UW-Madison, and we're talking about these cult-like followings to different brands. Let's go to Brian in Green Bay next. Brian, what's on your mind?
I just wanted to speak about a brand that I feel is a parallel to QuickTrip in Wisconsin. I'm originally from New Jersey, and we had a Wawa, which was similar in that it was a gas station and a convenience store. And I think part of the experience and the reason for my brand loyalty has to do with the fact that it was a nostalgic place for me to go to lunch every day during high school. You get your 6-inch shorty hoagie, and it was a place with a large selection in a town that was relatively small. And we can't forget that Quick Trip and its brand loyalty has a lot to do with its experience and being able to draw a parallel in smaller regions where there isn't really too much of a variety to offer.
Oh, Brian, thanks for sharing that. Not only the habit, but also the nostalgia, Tom.
Oh, sure. And I think, the more marketers always rely on nostalgia when in hard times or in anxious times. And we live in one of the most anxious periods socially that we have in a long time. And so nostalgia is very big right now. And so people gravitate to things that makes them feel home and familiarity and comfort. So the way I've actually been to the brand you described off the New Jersey Turnpike. And yeah, I think that is, there's some brands where I grew up in Texas that are that way, where you just feel like you're home. And that has an enormous emotional connection.
Let's also talk about social media. Alyssa writes on Facebook that whoever is running Quick Trip's social media needs a raise. They're hilarious. What about social media in this game of influencing consumers and creating these cult brands?
Well, it's changing. Excuse me. It's changing every day. They are very good at it. And they were early to be good at it. What is happening in social media is impossible to keep up with because of analytics and increasingly artificial intelligence and machine learning, where companies know so much about you that it is easy rather than to see you as 320 million individual targets or 320 million total targets, is to see you as 320 million individual targets and customize messages for you. So the trick on social media is to balance a customized message to you with something that has commonality that you'll relate to. And Coca-Cola was the world's most successful brand for over 100 years. It's now been replaced by Apple and Google as the third most valuable brand. And Coca-Cola always says that at the heart of their brand are two facets, sociality, you socialize with Coca-Cola, and community. And that is why Coca-Cola has been Coca-Cola for 100 years. And I think that's what great brands do.
Let's welcome Laura in Madison now. Laura, what are you following like a cult?
Well, unfortunately, the plant's closed, but I used to buy Rippin' Good Cookies. And now that they're closed, of course, you can't find them. You can't get them anymore. But they had kind of a cult following. They baked cookies that no one else baked. One of my favorites was the coconut macaroon sandwich cookie. But, it really was an identity for the town of Ripon, who also had cookie days and hundreds of people worked at the factory. And, so it was a big loss to the community. And that just happened a few years ago.
Laura, did you find it easy or difficult to transition your cookie love to another company?
Well, it was actually probably beneficial to me that I tapered off cookies. If I would see one of those packages, and Rippin' Good Cookies weren't that easy to find in the stores, but if I saw a package of those macaroon cookies, boy, I had to throw it into my basket.
I understand. Laura, thank you so much. Tom, Laura saying, I kind of stopped eating cookies as opposed to just picking up another brand.
Yeah, it's interesting. And that's not unusual at all. The best example of that, the first tablet computer that was built, sort of laptopish notebook thing, was Apple built the Newton. And the Newton was pulled by Apple, I don't know, 20 years ago. And there is still an active Newton community where they sell each other parts and batteries and talk about how great and they beg Apple to bring the Newton back. And so, yeah, when a brand becomes really important to you and it's taken away, it cements brand loyalty forever in you. And what there are companies that go buy those brand names and then reissue them. So maybe somebody will bring it back. I hope so.
All right. Dom, I do wonder, is this something that this cult-like following of brands, is this something that we've always done through the years, through the centuries, or is this something that's new in this age?
No, I think we've always had community. I mean, community goes back to the Greeks debated community and then cults. The early Christians, you know, were considered cultish. The only difference really is that for the last 130 some years, we've become a consumer society. We've always had given material objects special meaning, religious artifacts, etc. But we've normalized that to where consumer goods, where Andy Warhol paints a picture of a soup can or a Brillo box, and it becomes iconic. So, no, we've always done it. It's just become more central to our society than it used to be.
And probably word can spread faster now.
Absolutely.
So we find those communities even quicker than we used to.
It's very quick to find somebody else on this planet who is into the very same thing you are.
The takeaway, you are not alone.
Right.
Tom, thank you so much for this discussion. It's fascinating. Tom O'Gwin is a professor of marketing and the Irwin Mayer Distinguished Chair in Business at UW-Madison. Joined us in studio to talk about Wisconsin brands with cult-like followings. And you can continue this conversation with us on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about the issues that gray wolves cause for farmers in Wisconsin and why those wolves are important to some tribal members. The latest in the debate over the endangered species is ahead here on Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, learning you have cancer means making some intimidating decisions about treatments and financial coverage and your family life. We talk with a healthcare reporter who says despite her job, she was still unprepared when she got the diagnosis. First, gray wolves have a complicated story in Wisconsin. Gray wolves were driven to near extinction in the 1960s. With legal protection, the population rebounded. And now they're a problem for farmers who've seen their livestock killed and people who've lost pets and hunting dogs. Conservationists and Native Americans, though, want to see the safeguards continue for the species. Rich Kramer is a reporter for WPR based in Eau Claire. He collaborated with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism on a story about wolves in our state. Rich, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So it sounds like gray wolves still very much a contentious issue in Wisconsin, even if they don't grab headlines every day.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I thought that deer were like the most politicized animal in Wisconsin, and they certainly do garner a lot of attention with the different rules. CWD, for example, is a big concern. But wolves definitely take the cake in terms of getting people passionate one way or the other about any number of things, whether they should be protected federally or not, whether there are too many or too few. You could come at it from any angle and you'd find a disagreement.
You know, we talk about not wanting to present two sides of an argument, that we're talking about all sides, but there are a lot of sides to the gray wolves argument in Wisconsin.
There really are. you look at the population growth from the dozens in the 1980s and early 1990s into, you know, today there's the last count, there was over 900 wolves in the state. That should, you know, some people would look at that and see that as a huge success story. But there's a lot of others, I mean, particularly agricultural, you know, livestock producers, and also, you know, hunters, bear hunters who lose dogs. They look at that as saying it's out of control. We're not managing the species adequately enough. But then you've also got cultural concerns from Anishinaabe people who see the wolf as a brother and who feel that their fates are intertwined with this animal. And then conservationists who think that wolves shouldn't be delisted until they've recovered 100% of the territory that they held when they were, you know, in pre-European and colonial days. So it's all over the place. I mean, there's a lot of very passionate takes on this.
Sure, yeah. And I mean, that sounds like it's quite a bit. There's quite a bit to go if you look at it from that perspective. Others are saying they're recovered, I guess, recovered enough.
Yeah, and even the argument about whether they can, even if it's even possible for wolves to recover, recolonize all the territory that they had, you know, prior to Europeans coming to Wisconsin and to the Midwest and America. Some people say that can't be done because it's all developed. You know, there's shopping malls, there's subdivisions. I mean, it's not suitable wolf habitat. And then the DNR has also said that it's possible that we're seeing kind of the peak of the wolf's carrying capacity in Wisconsin because of that conflict that's happening as they spread into more populated areas of central like northeastern Wisconsin and down towards Black River Falls and more central, west central Wisconsin.
Yeah, so it's not even that everyone agrees on what end we want, just can't agree on the means to get there. It's that we don't all agree on the end. Rich Kramer is a WPR reporter based in Eau Claire. We're talking about gray wolves in Wisconsin and their status as endangered species. There is a line for you at 800-642-1234 if you'd like to talk about an encounter you've had with wolves or your position on whether gray wolves should remain on the endangered species list. Rich, you spoke to people for this story whose pets were killed or they had damage from wolves. What did they describe to you? What did they tell you about the effect that wolves have on their lives?
Well, so I spoke with a beef farmer. He raises pulled Hereford cattle in just north or just outside of Medford, Wisconsin, which is in the central part of the state, north central. And he lost a calf in 2014, I believe it was. And he said, not only, you know, he lost his calf that he could have sold for $800. He got $400 through this Wisconsin's wolf damage payment program. So, you know, that to him, he said that was a financial loss. But also, he said it was scary. He was afraid to let his grandchildren play in the woods in the area. I mean, there was this sense of something's always watching these animals that I'm trying to protect, and it was kind of stressful. And also he said that the cattle behave differently when they are being hunted. Whether or not they're attacked and killed, he said these cattle will act differently. They don't breed the same way. They don't eat, and that's important for these cattle to fatten up. And then I spoke with Lori Grosskopf, who's she's a longtime bear hunter, but she's kind of an advocate for raising awareness of the damage that can be caused by wolves, one of many, in north central Wisconsin. And she lost two of her hunting dogs, and she called them family. She said it was very traumatic because these animals were very close to her, and hunting is a big part of the culture up there, she says. So the whole experience was very traumatic.
Yeah, let's welcome Gary from Iron River now. Gary, what's your take?
A few things. One, folks, I'm from Bayfield County, and of course it's a rural county with like 15,000 people in the whole county. I think delisting is fine. I think it's ludicrous to pay reparations to hunters and their dogs. They're out hunting. They take a risk. It's the wilderness as the wilderness was. I also think we shouldn't be paying reparations to farmers. We should let people with cattle have either the dogs that they want to protect them, which we do, or let them shoot the wolves in their area. Mm. And this business of trying to subsidize the system by taking money from the taxpayers to pay individual little groups that benefit one way or the other just seems wrong to me.
All right, Gary, thanks for that. Rich, is this where the taxpayer money comes in, where we're trying to account for the costs that private owners have endured when wolves attack?
Sure. The state since 1985, the DNR, but it was created by the state legislature, this payment program, has been offering payment for cattle, you know, they call them hounds, that's hunting dogs, deer from deer farms, sheep, you know, all sorts of different animals. And to date, they've spent, you know, in that 34 years, more than $2.5 million. The payments generally for cattle, I mean, they don't draw as much controversy as the payments for hunting dogs. And it's just like the caller said, the idea is that people are bringing their dogs. They're hunting generally bear, but they can also hunt other animals like bobcats. But they're going into wolf territory, basically, at a time, sometimes during the summer months when wolves have young set up at what are called rendezvous sites. It was described to me as a wolf daycare. And they just don't tolerate any dogs coming through. And when you're hunting with a dog, the dog's way ahead of you on a big chunk of public land, and you're following radio signals. You can also hear them baying or, you know, barking at a bear that they tree. But the wolves just don't tolerate that. They kill the animals. So the payments for hunters or for hunting dogs is very controversial. Mm-hmm. And that's the number one of in all the individual categories. The majority of the funds in this wolf damage payment program have gone to hunting dogs. And then as far as the livestock producers, when the state had management authority, and this happened 2012 is when Wisconsin was allowed to, they created the wolf hunting bill, or the law, and part of that was they were able to issue permits to farmers to be able to shoot wolves that are attacking their animals. They issued, I can't remember how many, but it was only a fraction of the people that actually used those permits, but I heard anecdotally that people really felt they had a bit of a control, and they liked that. But now that they're back on the endangered species list because of a 2014 ruling, a federal court ruling, nobody can kill a wolf for any reason except for if there's an imminent danger to human health.
All right, let's take Nick from Green Bay as our last caller here quick. Nick, what's your perspective here?
I think the wolves are awesome. I think they should be left on the endangered species. I used to live at the KSR Air Force Base, the old base, and my black lab was barking at something, and I went out there, and there was a wolf coming up to him, and I know she's going to do something nasty to him, but I thought it was an awesome experience to see that wolf up close. And it was just a single wolf, and she saw me and took off down the road and no harm. So, and like the other guy said, I don't think we should be paying anybody for a wolf attack.
All right. Yeah, thanks, Nick. Rich, there's respect for animals in there in what Nick is saying. Do we generally know, as we wrap up here, how Wisconsinites feel about the wolves?
In 2014, I mean, it's a little dated by this time, but in 2014, there was some surveys. There was a survey done gauging attitudes, public attitudes about wolves. And overall, people did have more favorable than non-favorable opinions about wolves. But that changes depending on whether you live in what's called wolf country, which is mostly northern Wisconsin, central Wisconsin, or if you live outside of wolf country. So that's that has a big impact on how people generally view this animal.
All right. Well, this is certainly not the last time we'll talk wolves. Rich, thank you for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
It was Rich Kramer, WPR's reporter based in Eau Claire, and his latest deep dive is called As Wolves Recover, Calls in Wisconsin to End Endangered Species Listing Grow. He wrote it in collaboration with the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. You can read it on our website. Visit WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, we'll talk with a healthcare reporter about receiving a cancer diagnosis and how she dealt with some of the tough decisions that came next. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina. Schools were closed, events canceled in northern Wisconsin after more than 2 feet of snow fell over the weekend. We get the latest on the cleanup efforts and travel headaches coming up. First, a cancer diagnosis is scary. And after getting the news, many people have to make decisions about the right treatment and covering costs really quickly. Our next guest reports on the healthcare industry for a living, and yet she says after her own diagnosis, those decisions were still difficult. Alexandra Glorioso writes about politics and healthcare policy for Politico Florida. She's also sharing her own story about charting a course to recovery. Alexandra, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thanks for having me.
You know, you were diagnosed with breast cancer about a year and a half ago, 31 years old. What went through your head at that moment?
I think I was just in complete and utter shock. I was always healthy and a pretty athletic kid and have generally taken care of myself. And I, you know, didn't go to the doctor very often, but I guess I was like the classic person, the young person who didn't think that they needed health insurance. And I just thought a lot of that stuff was far off for me. So yeah, it was just completely overwhelming, I guess I would say.
And you write and you know, tell people that after your diagnosis, those first couple of days were so stressful, and you had to make choices really quickly. What was in front of you then?
Yeah, it's amazing how you know. In my case, I went to the doctor to change my birth control. I had just gotten into a new relationship and my IUD had expired and I needed another one. You know, you only need those every 5 years. And I told my gynecologist that I had found a lump in my breast, but I was pretty certain it was nothing. And then things moved very quickly. They were like, yeah, it's probably nothing, but we're just going to send you to get a mammogram. And they were like, okay, we're just going to take a quick biopsy. And, you know, I started to piece together one test after another that everyone was actually pretty concerned. And then when my diagnosis came back, it was like, okay, well, good luck with that. You know, go find your treatment program and we wish you the best. And I just couldn't believe it. I mean, you know, I felt like I was like sent off into this long, cold adventure on my own. And thankfully, I have a lot of experience being a reporter and reporting on healthcare. I knew basically what to do. I got all my insurance information. I figured out where I was qualified to get treated. My family is in science and medicine. And I quickly dialed up my dad, who's a scientist, who quickly connected me with a friend of his who's an oncologist. But I still had to go and get all my records in person. And then I had to, you know, ship them to the places that I wanted to get treated. And I had to beg for an in front of the line interview with an oncologist and a surgeon and weed through, you know, where I was going to go. And I ultimately ended up picking a treatment facility that was hours away from my home in Tallahassee, Florida, where I live and work. And even once I had decided to go to that facility, you know, there was just endless numbers of decisions to make after that. And the biggest one being, you know, do I participate in a clinical trial? And if so, which one? And I only had, you know, 2 days to make that decision. So the whole time I'm just thinking, like, I can't imagine what this would be like if I weren't a reporter.
Because even with that background, you didn't feel fully prepared. So you were just imagining people who didn't have those experiences?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a pretty educated person. You know, I studied economics in college. I have my master's in journalism. I essentially interview people about really dense healthcare topics for a living and translate them to the general public. And yet I consistently feel like I'm just shooting in the dark. And I think the thing that has been the most surprising about it to me is that no one's really responsible for my care. It's really up to me. And I really didn't know that going into this whole process. And I don't think that's something that's really been communicated to me as a reporter. And it's just been this completely eye-opening experience.
Alexandra Glorioso writes about politics and healthcare for Politico Florida. We're talking about her personal experience working and living with cancer. Alexandra, you made the choice not only to keep working, but to write really openly about your treatment. You're speaking openly about it. Why do you do that?
Well, I mean, for one thing, it's like I kind of have this like front row seat I've always wanted. I mean, I don't really want it to be through myself, but you know, as a reporter, it's like all you want is access. And I'm a legislative reporter, so I cover policy changes and money and, you know, the state government. And so I feel all the time like I'm so many degrees removed from actual patients and the trials and tribulations that they endure. And so on some level, it's like my intellectual curiosity, I guess, is driving this. But on another level, also, you know, it's so hard and isolating to be a patient and to feel this burden of, you know, constantly taking your life in your own hands and making these complicated decisions that really could kill you at the end of the day. And so I guess I've also turned to it as a way to cope. You know, I've long been writing as a way to deal with lots of things. And, you know, in some ways this is no different. And it's like, you know, I feel sort of helpless, I guess, having this omnipresent disease. You know, right now I'm in remission for breast cancer, so I'm not under direct threat, but it could really come back at any time. And it's always with me. So I guess I feel like the only thing I can really do is communicate to the world as best I can what that experience is like.
Tell us about being welcomed to the Cancer Club.
Yeah, it's this really amazing group of people. You know, because I'm a reporter, I have an online presence and, you know, a Twitter following and things like that. That I think really kind of put my introduction into the Cancer Club into hyperdrive. And, you know, I really announced to the world that I had a cancer diagnosis shortly after I was diagnosed through a Politico magazine piece. And, you know, I've written two essays now for them about it. And after that, you know, I kept getting these emails, you know, and these direct messages on Twitter saying, oh, welcome to the best and worst club. Nobody wants to be in it, but the greatest people are here. And it really is true, I think, because it's this group of patients who are organized loosely online and, you know, I guess in person sometimes, who are passing advice to each other about how to select different treatment programs, how to deal with side effects, you know, offering emotional support. And at first, I didn't really think that I wanted to be in this club. I'm a millennial, so I guess I rebel against these things anyway, you know, structure and organization, and also being a reporter. But also, I just thought that, you know, this isn't going to really affect me. I've got a stage 2 cancer diagnosis. I'm going to be in and out. It's not a big deal. And it really has upended my entire life, and it's been the most difficult thing I've ever had to deal with, and it's completely changed my priorities. It's completely changed my group of friends, and, you know, I really have grown to depend very greatly on this club, from small things like what kinds of over-the-counter drugs can I help, you know, with cramps and pains caused by my different drugs, to just, you know, why am I so alone? Why do I feel so alone? Why do I feel this enormous existential crisis all the time about, you know, this vast landscape of death that I look onto every day? And it's comforting to know that there are other people out there who can relate to how you feel.
Yeah. Alexandra, thank you for sharing your story. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Alexandra Glorioso writes about politics and healthcare policy for Politico Florida, and she shared her own personal experience with cancer. You can read it at WPR.org/Central Time. And join us on the Ideas Network tomorrow for live coverage of the House Judiciary starting at 9 o'clock. The committee is tasked with drafting articles of impeachment. NPR live coverage again begins on Wednesday at 9 a.m. here on the Ideas Network. And today, we at WPR are celebrating our music librarian. Denny Ryan has worked here for 50 years today, 50. And it's because of Denny's care and skill that we have an extraordinary library of music. He programs music, helps people around WPR and our listeners with music questions. Denny knows the history of Wisconsin Public Radio. He's had to embrace a lot of change in the last half century. He started as a part-timer back when he was in college, and this work became his career. On our website, we've got more about Denny, including photos of him that are a few decades old, one from now. Just visit WPR.org to read about his favorite memories, what he listens to outside of work. Spoiler alert, there's some classical music in there alongside the Allman Brothers Band and Richie Sambora. Denny, thank you for your dedication to this work, your dedication to our listeners. These 50 years would not have been the same without you, and we are looking forward to more. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll find out how northwestern Wisconsin is doing after getting blasted by a major snowstorm over the weekend. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.